Well, we're back. John Fesco, Fred Sanders, I'm Matthew Barrett, and of course we've got Scott Swain over here. We're coming together, calling this a Credo or Credo Alliance, and maybe we need that more than ever right now because we are going to tackle none other than Thomas Aquinas himself. And Fred,
it takes four of us to tackle him.
Yeah,
I think he's a pretty big guy, actually.
Yeah, it might take a little bit of muscle to bring down the ox. He certainly was not dumb. Now, Fred, I've seen this picture just floats around occasionally, and I don't know if you've seen it, but there's this picture of Fred. Maybe it's a younger Fred.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely
early,
younger
early
Fred.
Early seminary.
Okay.
Wearing
Did you
shorts.
Have a beard?
I think so.
Okay, you had a beard. Okay. And he's standing there, and I think you have piled the Summa and maybe some other works, and it's like above his head. It's a great picture.
Yeah, it's the 60-volume Blackfriars edition. Yes. And then maybe Garrigou Lagrange. It's a bunch of commentaries on top of that. So it was about 6 feet tall.
Now, I don't know if you meant this, but I looked at that picture and I thought, Fred is, I mean, he's like flexing his intellectual muscles. Look at what I've read. But, I mean, that picture... And maybe you can think back to that point in your life for each of us, right? When did you first read Thomas Aquinas, and why in the world would you read Thomas Aquinas?
Yeah, no, I do remember it really clearly because it was a couple of years into seminary, maybe exactly 2 years in. I had heard from a lot of reputable sources that this is one of the biggies if you want to really get your head around Christian theology. You got to face Thomas at some point. I was at Asbury Seminary. And several good scholars there had told me, read Aquinas, but there was no course on Aquinas. So I said, well, what do I do about that? So I contracted for an independent study over the summer.
Okay.
And we were actually going to go to South Carolina and take care of a house for the summer. And I was going to work in a t-shirt printing factory and learn commercial screen printing. But in the evenings, with my spare time, I was going to read the entire Summa. It was like a 3-unit class. And I remember the contract said, I'm going to skim parts of it. And I'm after the doctrinal parts. I don't care much about the theology or about the philosophy. I'm there for the doctrinal theology. And there's probably too much about angels in there, so I'll probably skim some of that. Anyway, that was my initial survey. And then as I got into it, I thought, like, the angel stuff is the best part. And there's no way to get the philosophy out of it. It's critically engaged at all times. And so... it was a great summer, you know, printed t-shirts all day and read the Summa all night. Good times.
Yeah. Sounds like an 80s rock song.
Oh, John, what about you?
When I was working on my dissertation, I was doing work on the doctrine of election. And so you wanted to go ahead and trace that through the Middle Ages. And, I had heard some things about Aquinas on election and then obviously confirmed them. Oh, wow, he's as Augustinian for the most part as Augustine is on election. And so that was an interesting twist because when you're in seminary, you hear a lot of the, I don't know what you want to call it, the urban legends, if you will, as to who lines up where and who's doing what. And, you know, supposedly Aquinas is just a medieval, so he doesn't read the Bible and, you know, it's all about, Roman Catholicism, thus foreknowledge. And so, you know, once you push past the urban legends and you actually start reading the text itself, then you figure, oh, wow, there's more to the story here than you first realize. But then in addition to that, later on, when I started doing, work on the Trinity, I think that for as much of the 20th century that got billed as a renaissance of Trinitarianism, whether because of Barth or, you know, Moltmann or others, I often got the impression that there was not a whole lot there theologically. And so I started digging back and, you know, remembering some of the stuff that I'd read in Aquinas. And, you know, I thought, boy, I started, you know, assigning it to my students saying, you know, you've got to read, you know, the first 43 questions of the Summa, that's some solid material there. And it's going to make you think very deeply about the doctrine of the Trinity. But not only that, but but also scripturally and exegetically. But I think what had got me onto that path was, reading a number of the Reformed scholastics, whether it's Owen or Turretin, and you'd see, and part of me doesn't understand why this evades people's attention, because you'll have some otherwise, people that, I'm very Reformed, and so I'm reading a Turretin, I'm reading an Owen, okay, great. But I don't know if it's because maybe the marginal notes are in the margins or because they're just kind of, abbreviated references, but you want to say, are you noticing that that's a positive citation of Aquinas there? Yeah. But oh no, I only read Reformed authors. So it was that, that breadcrumb trail that led me back to Aquinas to say, I need to dig in deeper here if these Reformed theologians are positively citing. That's not to say they always agree, but I thought there's more here. So that's what got me onto that whole path.
I don't think it's the first time I read Thomas Aquinas, but it's the first time I remember reading Thomas Aquinas, if the distinction makes sense. And it was in my doctoral program at TADS in a history of theological anthropology course with Doug Sweeney. Oh. And so we read excerpts from actually both summas related to anthropology and nature and grace. But the thing that stuck out to me from that encounter was we were using one of these, I think it's Anthony Pages or kind of compilations, you get excerpts.
Yeah.
And it had a really nice introduction that explained how a medieval disputation works so that you'll know how to read it. And so I always like learning how to read a foreign text. At least the genre is foreign to me. And so I was really delighted to see that, once someone just points out how this works, you can follow the argument quite well and come to realize that this strange text is actually pretty clear in the kind of claims it's making. And yes, there's some philosophy eventually you got to pick up, and you probably need to understand some traditional debates that are in the background, but the presentation itself was in some ways crystal clear.
Mm. Yeah, it's hard for me to remember. I do have this distinct memory when I was a college student at Biola University, and I think one of my professors must have said something, and I just remember going to the bookstore. And there was one copy left of Thomas, and I started to work through it. And it was a section on the doctrine of God. And at the time, I thought, there's a lot here. I'm not sure I have learned the language yet. And that was, at first, that was a hurdle and made me think, okay, I need to take a step back and learn what he's trying to do before I can understand how he's making this argument for God or for a particular divine attribute. But then I remember, Fred, your story is I resonate a lot with, because then I came back. And when I was in seminary, there was, and this is sometimes a common thing at some seminaries, they'll have a class on the Church Fathers. Then they skip to the Reformation, and then they'll have another class on, modern theologians. And here you have 1,000 years of history, well, half of history, and there's no teaching on it, let alone, a specific class on Thomas Aquinas. And so I had to do just an independent type of course that I essentially created to have the opportunity to dig into Thomas. I think it was at that point I started to realize some of the things you mentioned, John, that some of the caricatures that just, float around and people just assume there's more going on here. Now, John, you said something really fascinating. You said even with your students, you start to tell them, hey, what was it, the first 48?
43 or 48.
43.
Yeah, something like that.
These questions and answers are really important. in light of the Trinitarian and Christological, some real Trinitarian Christological challenges in our day, and even before us in the 20th century. I mean, you think, for example, of the rise of canonic Christology, and how many were kind of swept into that. Or there's so many examples we could you know pick on. How does your reading returning to Thomas on some of those issues? Why is that not harmful, but actually quite helpful to even understanding the orthodoxy that came before Thomas?
Yeah. I think for me, the way I try to explain it to my students is that in the present day, we're kind of living in a hyper-specialized kind of environment where you can have somebody doing exegesis, but maybe at least in his or her mind, not doing theology, or certainly not doing historical theology. Whereas if you rewind the clock to the Middle Ages, because theologians have an obligation to tradition, even though Aquinas says that tradition is essentially a probable authority, unlike later Roman Catholicism, but he says a probable authority, he's interacting with the history of interpretation. He's interacting with the history of doctrine because he sees himself as being a part of that ongoing discussion, that ongoing dialogue. So I think he sees a moral obligation to engage it and to discuss it and to interact with it so that you don't necessarily find that kind of thing going on as much. It does happen in some authors, but not as much in the 20th century, for example. I jokingly say this, the 20th century wasn't a good season for us. I don't think we made the playoffs. There were some standout performances, but as a whole, it wasn't the best century for theology. But in reading a medieval like Aquinas, it's a really engaging read in it because he's bringing in that ancient discussion and he's aware of those issues so that it can, in relatively short order, maybe an asterisk, it's not an easy, you know, it's sure. An easy read, but in relative short order, you can get dialed into a lot of those issues and have a further breadcrumb path to those discussions as to who the authors are so that you can dig in further. So it's immensely informative, I think, in that way.
Scott, so John mentioned, you're a Reformed theologian, and John mentioned a minute ago how he started to read some of the Protestant scholastics, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, he's reading John Owen and he's noticing, wait a minute, there seems to be some interaction here or even debt to Thomas on any number of issues. So this is a question that I think maybe all of us have had to wrestle with at some point. One approach, right, could be, okay, I'm going to go back to Thomas Aquinas and just kind of pick whatever I like and get rid of whatever I don't like. And sometimes I've had people come to me and say, tell me what it is, you know, and they just want the good and then take out the bad and then, okay. And I've usually said to them, forget Thomas Aquinas, like with anyone, that's probably not the best approach. I mean, you probably wouldn't read your Bible that way, and reading classical texts that way could, you know, that might get you in trouble as well. It can be a little rough. When you look at the Reformed scholastics as a Reformed theologian yourself, they seem to be doing something a bit deeper than that. They seem to understand to some degree, okay, we have a foot in this stream. Mm-hmm. We are retrieving and really joining this conversation, which, as you mentioned, doesn't just include theology, but philosophy. So there's a certain continuity there, or even Catholicity. But then they're also Protestants. And so it seems to be like they're thinking through, okay, how do I retain that Catholicity, but also bring it forward, not just so that my Protestant principles aren't compromised, but maybe those Protestant principles actually advance.
Yeah.
So my question to you is, where have you seen that done? How is it best done? Do you ever try to do that yourself? Mm. How does Thomas help you, or maybe doesn't help you at times?
Yeah. Talking about retrieving Thomas Aquinas as a Protestant, and I think I would say that when it comes to 16th and 17th century Protestants, they're not retrieving Thomas. They actually think he's part of the tradition they belong to. Yeah. Whether it's Calvin talking about the saner scholastics, mm-hmm. or someone like Peter Martyr Vermigli, who would have been trained in this tradition. When he becomes a Protestant, yes, there are certain things that he rejects that the Church of Rome is teaching, but he doesn't think that means he has to take a kind of about-face stand against Thomas Aquinas. Yeah. And so you'll see that in his addressing a number of different questions, he will give a Thomistic spin. You think of Zanke, which is his student as well, the way he structures his discussion of the doctrine of the being and attributes of God and the Trinity. This reflects very much those first 43 questions of Thomas in the Summa. I think it's important to say that Protestants aren't Dominicans, mm-hmm. but the Reformed theologians aren't Dominicans in the sense that they believe themselves as belonging to Thomas's school, mm-hmm. right? There is what has sometimes been described as an eclectic appropriation of not only medieval doctors, but church fathers. And so on the one hand, you'll see the Reformed taking very much Thomist positions on things like analogy, mm. and analogical language, talking about the divine attributes or divine simplicity, mm. or even defining virtues. And John has written on this topic. But then in a place like Christology, where the Lutherans tended to be more Thomistic and then add their little kind of Lutheran tweak to it, you see the Reformed following maybe more SCOTUS. So there are principles informing that. I think there are principles that kind of help us think about that. But when we're having to think about, well, what should we do here as 21st century Protestants? I think there is a sense in which we have to talk about retrieving someone like Thomas. But that's in the name of being more Protestant, not less. Mm-hmm. There was this kind of thing, and you see it in Schleiermacher, you see it in Dorner, where they'll say the Reformation brought us great insight on the nature of salvation, the nature of faith, the nature of even anthropology, but Protestants did not consistently apply those insights in the doctrine of God. And if we're going to consistently apply those insights, then we might need to reform the doctrine of God. Well, you can find those kinds of arguments not only among kind of, you know, famous liberal or mediating Protestants, you can find those arguments among contemporary fairly conservative Protestants as well. But the irony, from my perspective, is actually become less Protestant when you do that. And so if you want to confess the kinds of things that Protestant confessions confess about God, you probably need, if not directly Thomas Aquinas, you need the kind of judgments he's making, the kinds of judgments that the broader Western tradition are making about the doctrine of God. And so in that sense, he's very helpful.
Hi, friends. This is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting this conversation to tell you about something quite exciting. Each November, we have a special meeting hosted by the Center for Classical Theology. This is an arm of Credo, and it's an opportunity to come together once a year in order to hear a lecture from a well-known theologian in order to renew and restore classical theology today. This November, Michael Horton will be giving this lecture, and he will be addressing us in San Diego, California, talking to us about what it means to affirm Sola Scriptura as it was originally intended, and how we do that in light of Catholicity. I look forward to hearing what he has to say, followed by a panel of other theologians discussing it as well. I hope you will join me in San Diego this November.
Fred, I mean, a close read in history shows it's not just a reformed phenomenon. I was just reading recently, and it was remarkable in how many Lutherans were having the same discussion, 16th, 17th century, even 18th century. So I mean, I'd be curious, Fred, how has this come into your world in different ways?
Yeah, it's interesting to talk through these things. There's kind of a denominational grid that sort of locks in, which can be over determinative for sorting out who's on which team. Because on the one hand, it's like, we should retrieve Thomas or someone like him. Like at the first level, it's like, there's a lot.
Read some Bonaventure.
Bonaventure, Scotus, whatever. I just mean like big, really smart medieval scholastic stuff is going to be helpful for us. And then similarly, when you think about, well, what do we mean by we retrieving it? I'm just on team Protestant in as far as that goes, especially when we're working on things like the doctrine of God, doctrine of Christ. Those large and only recently translated Protestant scholastic tomes that kind of work through this in any kind of detail are all, if you want to learn to read those well, kind of the shortest route to get there is to go back and learn to read the high scholastics well, and then sort of descend to the synopsis of a purer theology or Maastricht or someone like that. Not because they're Dominicans or something, but because they're doing a version of that with some, occasional updates and line item vetoes. And in Maastricht's case, a real concern to be more transparent to Scripture and have less sort of the artificiality of the traditional guidance be leading.
Now, if we fast forward from Thomas, there's all kinds of things happening, but one of them is, Thomas puts forward a fairly robust understanding of natural theology. Now, there's a lot of caricatures about that and misunderstandings. He weds faith and reason quite closely together in a type of harmony that understands them in a proper place. When we get, though, to subsequent centuries, that starts to get picked apart and, in worst case scenario, starts to crumble in some significant ways. When we think of, say, if something's in maybe seed form with someone like a Duns Scotus, by the time you get to Occam, it starts to really become more apparent, let alone someone like Gabriel Biel. John, you've thought about this quite a bit, I know, and not just in terms of natural theology, but then even how this starts to bleed into soteriology. Mm-hmm. What is that shift? What is that progression, both in terms of, what's happening in terms of natural theology itself, and then how does it like take on a life of its own in terms of matters of soteriology?
That's a huge question. I feel like you've asked me, give us the history of the world in three sentences. So I'll do my best. I can remember going surfing once and friends of mine waving me off saying, don't try that wave. You're going to get tossed. So I can hear people saying, don't try to answer this question. You're going to get tossed, but I'll go for it. You certainly have the harmony between faith and reason in a Duns Scotus, and then certainly in an Occam, begin to erode with less of a confidence or an undermining of the legitimacy of a natural theology. You could say that the reformers restore a lot of that, though it wasn't one of their chief concerns. Like you have to read very carefully the opening five chapters of Calvin's Institutes to see his version of a natural theology. It's similar in conviction, but somewhat different in how he executes it. And so that largely holds. It becomes clear in a Turretin, but then it unravels once again in the late scholastic period, where they begin to coordinate not so much as a harmony between faith and reason, but putting reason over faith. And so natural theology kind of unravels from there. That, you can say, that kind of a trend has an impact upon soteriology. At least as it is in Aquinas, for example. Aquinas is a strong proponent of grace, so he's not a Pelagian, in contrast to an Occam or a Beale, they're very Pelagian in the nature, you know, do what is within you and God will not deny you his grace. That whole understanding of soteriology. You know, there's a line in among some historians who, especially Roman Catholics, who say had Luther encountered Aquinas, maybe the Reformation wouldn't have happened. But instead he encountered Beale and Occam. And I'm not persuaded of that. I think Luther is doing something significantly different enough from Aquinas that he would have been able to see that, no, there's a difference of opinion there. So it certainly gets propelled in the Reformation understanding of soteriology, where there is a significant difference. Maybe this needs some more nuance, but arguably you could say Trent large in part codifies Aquinas at the Council of Trent and his understanding of salvation. There's an article that I've read recently that pushes back, that says for Augustine, justification was not an ongoing process, but was a definitive moment in the person's salvation. And so he argues, and I thought somewhat persuasively, that Augustine is more of a predecessor, or at least the ancient roots of the Reformed tradition in its soteriology. So that's something that needs some more teasing out. But I think when you combine the erosion of the chief place of faith in a Reformed soteriology, that began to erode its understanding of salvation. And so you get especially towards the end of the 17th century, you get debates among neonomians, legalists, and antinomians as to the proper nature of salvation. And you get some folks that come out in the middle. John Owen is one of those players in those late discussions, at least some of his works earlier on. But there was a careful balance that was lost, but there's a sense in which Aquinas on some of those discussions is an ally, and in others those discussions maybe not so much of an ally, but more of somebody to be criticized. So there was I think going back to what Scott said, there was a principled eclecticism. Mm-hmm. We'll pull some of this in and we'll push some of that out.
When Thomas Aquinas comes up, and you're all teachers as well, right? And so from time to time, someone may say to you, well, John, you can't have your students read Thomas Aquinas. What if they become Roman Catholic? How do we, on the one hand, we're not denying that we, as Protestants, have some serious, significant disagreements with Thomas on, well, we could sit here and probably talk about some of those areas, right? So how do we don't want to pretend that that's not the case, but and we should take that seriously, but at the same time, how do we go about engaging Thomas, recommending Thomas to read, even like you were saying, Scott, today we're in this position of retrieval, but when we look at some of those Protestant classics before us, they just see themselves as part of that same tradition. So how do we hold on to both of those? And what do you say? What do you say to that person that's afraid and says, well, if you tell someone to read, surely they're going to become a Roman Catholic. Now, there have been instances of some Protestants that do that have become Roman Catholics, whether it has to do with Aquinas or not. But so it's not that that's not a, not real, but at the same time, there is this fear-based mentality that says, let's get rid of Thomas entirely. That's just going to lead people in the wrong direction. I've even seen people say, well, why would you ever read Thomas Aquinas? You can just go read, you know, a John Owen, and he's better anyway. So what's the point? What do you say to some of these types of objections?
I can admit John Owen's better at what he's better at. Yeah. So I teach undergrads. If you're dealing with bright young people who are growing intellectually in ways that you are not going to have control over, and you're concerned that they're going to learn there's goodies out there somewhere, it's really counterproductive to tell them, hands off, that's a danger zone, it's a no-fly area. It's just going to incentivize them to think, why can't we have nice things? Is it because we're Protestant? You know. So I'm not saying you got to, like, you know, give them a little ground or something. But if they're trying to sort out sort of this distinction in their mind that's not even thematically clear to them, like, what is my full Christian patrimony? Do I get everything, or am I part of a narrow sect that only is allowed to do certain things? And they, you know, they're sorting it out in decisions about how they're supposed to dress and all, you know, all sorts of things that they will later see are not as important as they seem at age 20. They really are kind of making that decision. Is the whole Christian truth mine? Yeah. Or do I have to only stick to a certain set of things? Mm. And I think equipping them with introductions to everything is the right way to go.
Yeah. Equipping them. That's the key word.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. There's the patrimony question. Do these resources belong to us as well, or are they really the property of the Roman Catholic Church or something? When it comes to someone like Thomas, the reason not to just read Owen and pick up what Thomas you need from Owen is that Thomas is truly one of the great theologians of the church. To develop a capacity for reading Thomas is a great way to equip yourself to continue to grow intellectually, spiritually. I think we want to teach, you know, is it Newman it says to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. But actually, I thought, you know, no, actually to be deep in history is very consistent with Protestantism. And you make an argument that it pushes you more towards Protestantism. And so part of the way to address the what about Thomas is just to do better teaching history in general. And so, you know, in talking about there's a reason Protestants thought Thomas was great on faith and reason, and there's a reason they thought he was really bad on the order of salvation. Mm-hmm. But you have to get into kind of medieval Christendom and what that order of salvation was and why Thomas is one of the great systematizers of that. And to talk about why the Reformation was a rejection of that whole system, you know. But why did they not think rejecting that whole system required rejecting Thomas on faith and reason? And as soon as you can start getting those kinds of questions, you can actually help them to understand the logic of Protestantism even more deeply. And even where they do reject that tradition, I mean, I think of some John's work on Thomas and virtue, right? So you've got to kind of get Thomas' understanding of grace and virtue out of your doctrine of justification, mm-hmm. right? Because you're misunderstanding justification if you're trying to think of it as based upon God's grace renewal in us. But once you've done that, all of a sudden, this understanding of the order of salvation that you're rejecting, you can then take his understanding of grace and virtue and put it in the right place in sanctification. So helping students understand the logic of those kinds of things actually, I think, makes them better Protestants, but also able to draw from these rich resources that belong to all of us.
This seems like there's almost a certain freedom there.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, in that case, there's a certain freedom to say, okay, it's wrong here, but I can relocate that where it should go.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, one of the mindsets we have to get people out of is, you know, it's concomitant with modernity. It's the idea of a worldview that is a closed system, or the idea of Hegelian holism, that you can't know any one part of the truth apart from the whole truth. And so it's just an all-contained system, so that if something doesn't fit, or if it's problematic, well, then you set aside the entire body of thought. And that's simply not the way that pre-moderns or early moderns thought. They said, no, I can take this element and I can put it over here, and so that you can pull the very best of it. And so it's a principled eclecticism. We've mentioned that before. And it's the idea that, no, my commitment is to the truth, not to any one school of thought or any one particular theologian. And I think especially in the wake of modernity, with the influence of romanticism and the hero or the genius theologian, that I have to follow everything that this one thinker says, we set that aside and say, no, it's not any one theologian that is the key to unlocking, you know, the secret mysteries of scripture, but rather it's like, you know, I'm sure you guys have read this, it's that one statement from the preface to Bovink's original edition of the Dogmatics, Volume 1, where he says that, Thomas is as much of a father to us Protestants as he is to Rome. So are the rest of the church fathers. They are not the sole property of Rome. They are as much ours as they are theirs. And so, yeah, so let's soak it in and let's see what they have to say, and let's learn from them.
That's a great line. I love that line. And I have found that to be so true, especially with mentoring some younger students. Like you kind of hinted at, Fred, if I say to them, oh, you know, don't read that, that's all bad.
It's the forbidden fruit, all of a sudden. Yeah.
Suddenly they want the cookies that are on the table. And but more seriously, it's like saying to them, well, as a Protestant, you don't have any rights to those roots, that heritage. And suddenly that could actually push them to become Roman Catholic, which is so ironic about the fear of, as opposed to saying, be judicious, like you were, I mean, if you were reading Augustine, or if you're, and understand that there's a sense in which you as a Protestant can say to your Roman Catholic friend, on what grounds do you have sole right or a monopoly on Thomas Aquinas? Are there ways that as a Protestant, actually we are then stepping into that tradition as well. That tends to then open up a conversation rather than, like you're saying, this is the forbidden fruit. And then suddenly you either just close your mind to it, or you think, oh, if I go for that, then I have to become Roman Catholic. It's very, very black and white. Yeah. So,
you know, even when you get to 16th century anti-Protestant Roman Catholics, someone like Cardinal Bellarmine.
Yeah.
I read Bellarmine on Christology and think, oh, there's some great stuff here. Yeah. Like, no one else said it quite that well. That's really, I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
And that's someone who, I don't have to guess if he disagreed with Protestantism. He knew all about it and argued against it. And so he's not on my team.
Yeah.
With Aquinas, you're centuries before, though, and he's not an anti-Protestant Roman Catholic. He's got specifiable doctrines that are in definite tension with Protestant claims, but it's a whole different thing. But I'm saying, even with anti-Protestant Roman Catholics in the 16th century, you can still learn critically from them, and especially in the areas that are...
Did.
What's that?
Protestants did.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, especially in Doctrine of the Trinity, they're like, oh, yeah, have you read the latest Jesuit thing on the Trinity?
Yeah.
It's great.
I think most Protestants would be shocked. Yes, they would be shocked as to how many anti-Protestant Roman Catholics the Protestants cited favorably.
Yeah. Well, this whole conversation, I think, is a really healthy one to have, maybe overdue in some senses, right, in which there's all kinds of caricatures floating around or misunderstandings, and so coming together like this to kind of think out loud about someone like Thomas Aquinas is, I hope that can happen more. And if folks enjoyed this, watch and listen to our other discussion on the Holy Spirit, in which we get into eternal spiration as well.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.